to resume our session. Maybe before we restart, so I do just get out of the way some of the logistics that are going to be needed continuously in the meeting. I'm going to ask Advocate Bauer to just attend to this issues of judgment and the information thereof.
Thank you, Chair. So we have endeavored to put the most relevant judgments together in a folder. If Advocate Mpofu, if you can give us, when you refer to a judgment, which case it is and the paragraph, and we will endeavor to put it up on the screen so that the members could follow, and then there would be less, then they'd be able to know what we're talking about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm hoping we'll proceed as such. Advocate Mpofu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you. Yes, I think that would be helpful also for the members to see what we're talking about. Mr. Ibrahim?
Just switch on your mic, Mr. Ibrahim. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. All right. Okay, you heard what has been said. So you have access at least to one of the screens. Yes. Okay. I owe you an apology for the reference. I couldn't find my judgment. But I'm sure, have you been told which passage it is?
No.
Okay. Right. Okay. It's if you go to the 2018 judgment, and as I say, I apologize for giving you the wrong reference. The part that I was referring to you to is 206, paragraph 206. You got that?
Yeah.
But I think it would be helpful to do this again.
Okay.
So that, because this is crucial for this committee in particular. The aim of this part of the cross-examination is to establish for the committee, or rather to assist it, to establish when it meets or whenever it makes decisions, whether this is a futile exercise or whether should, as some of its members have suggested, seek legal advice, or whether it should go ahead regardless. Okay. Now, you are aware that there is a need, in terms of Section 194, I think you've said this in fairness to you in your own document, there needs to be what is referred to as an institutional predetermination of the existence of the ground. Right? Agreed?
That's correct, yes.
Yes. And that institutional predetermination precedes the actual removal process, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yes. And the tail cannot wag the dog. So you must start with the institutional predetermination. Once you have a finding, then you get into removal proceedings, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And the part that I'm going to read to you establishes that. And then I'll come back to the question that I was going to ask. If you indulge me, let's go back to 204. But the process and decision, section 89.1. Okay, I'm sorry to do this. So every time when I say section 89, that's why I had this 289 in my head. Every time when I say section 89, for the purposes of this discussion, you must substitute section 194. You understand the exercise? Do you understand the exercise? In other words, an impeachment process for the president is not what we're busy with here. Well, it's public protest. But I'm talking about the principle. Do you understand?
Yes.
Pardon?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So when I say Section 89 in your head, you must think 194. Okay, but the process envisaged in Section 89(1), that means in an impeachment process, involves necessarily an antecedent determination by the Assembly to the effect that one of the listed grounds exists. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
And this is because those are grounds for the President's removal. With regard to the motion, this was not done. It was simply tabled, debated, and voted on. Right? Now, you said in your testimony that when it comes to the process, it is an identical process, whether it's the president of the or the public protector, correct?
Correct.
You did, in fairness to you, make the distinction that when it comes to the merits, the standard to be satisfied, what my learned friend, there's a hierarchy. We're not talking about that now. We're talking about the process, which is identical, correct?
Yes.
Fine. Now, it says, the Assembly did not approach the process of a motion on the footing that the President has indeed committed serious violation of the Constitution. I know about that. That's on the fact of that matter. Here's the important part. This was a necessary condition for commencing a Section 89 process. You understand what that means?
Yeah.
That the determination of the existence or non-existence of the ground is a necessary condition for the commencement of the process, of the impeachment process.
Okay.
You agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it says, without accepting that one of the listed grounds existed, and the word existed is important, the Assembly could not authorize the commencement of a process which could result in the removal of the President from office. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
And it goes back to where we started, that the one process is you cannot do the second one without having done the first one. You can't do the removal process without having done the determination of the existence of the ground process. Agreed?
The predetermination related to
existence of the ground.
And the definition that needed to be utilized. So it was a predetermination of really what meant by misconduct, serious misconduct, whatever. It's not a question of the grounds. It's a question of really the predetermination of the definitions, so as to ensure that there was no dispute around what was meant by misconduct or serious misconduct.
No, Mr. Trump, please. But that's the same thing. That's the ground for removal, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a definition of the issues.
But that's otherwise known as the ground. Yes, good. Yeah. So I don't know what we're debating now. Now, it says, moreover, it does not appear from the papers the President has afforded an opportunity to defend himself, not knowing whether the Assembly holds the view that the President has committed a serious violation of the Constitution, it would be difficult for him to mount an effective defense. The procedure followed by the Assembly here does not accord with Section 89. That's where I wanted to start.
Yeah.
What I was asking you before lunch. So for whatever reason, if the procedure does not accord with Section 194, then I was saying to you that would mean that the process is liable to be set aside, to be reviewed and set aside.
Yes, it has to comply with the Constitution, yes.
Okay, thank you. I think the lunch assistant. Okay, 206, the paragraph 206. If that motion had succeeded, in other words, if the motion which was tainted by the illegality had succeeded, it would not have constituted impeachment and removal of the president as contemplated in Section 89(1). Usual rules. Agreed?
Yeah.
Instead, it would have been an unconstitutional removal of the president from office and would have been liable to be certified on review. That's the real issue I was putting to you on before lunch. Do we now agree?
Yes.
Good. Right. So now let's come to this procedure to see whether it is the one described here, which would be a waste of time, or another one, which might serve some purpose. All right. Now, you said something that worried me a bit, so I would like you to explain it. It said Section 194 does not concern the person, but it concerns an institution. That was a source of some confusion here yesterday, and I don't want you to add to that confusion. Is that what you said?
Excuse me, please say that again.
Did you testify in chief this morning that Section 194 does not concern a person but concerns an institution, an office?
Yes.
It did? Okay,
yes.
Good.
Removal from office. 194 deals with removal from office. So it's a removal of a person from the office, yes.
Sir, please. Did you or did you not testify that Section 194 involves the removal concerns the an office and not a person?
No, it's not removal of the office, it's removal of the person. You have to Section 194 reads, the public protector, the auditor general, or members of the commission established by the chapter may be removed.
Mr. Ibrahim, you know, you'll spend a lot less time if you listen to the question and answer
okay.
it. Yeah. Did you,
yes.
Mr. Ibrahim, yes or no, say this morning that the Section 194 concerns an office and not a person? Either you said it or you didn't say it. You didn't say it.
Remove of the person from office.
Okay, I'm trying for the last time. Mr. Ibrahim,
yes.
Did you...
Sorry,
you have not answered the question. It's a simple yes or no. He said it or he didn't say it. Did you say this morning or did you not say that Section 194 concerns an office and not a person? I mean, how difficult is that?
Removal of the person from the office.
Yeah.
He repeated that again.
No, he must answer the question yes
he's
or no.
The question,
no.
He might not like the
no,
question.
No, it doesn't matter.
Yes.
He's answering it now, Shepherd. I'm asking about the morning. Please.
He's clarifying himself what he said.
No.
You might have to help us. Just hold, Mr. Mbovu. You might have to help us. You are here. You must make that specific reference in his presentation. He's in front of you. So we deal with that specific issue.
Thank you, Chairperson.
And not throw a general question.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's not a general question. It's not general. It's you. You, Mr. Perry Ibrahim. Not general.
Can you point us now to that?
Only one, Mr. Ibrahim. Yeah.
Yes.
Not general.
Point us, Mr. Mbovu. Please point us to what you want him to respond to. It's in his presentation.
Chairperson. You want me to continue with this exercise?
I want you to assist us so that we're with you.
Then let me ask a question. I'm asking a very simple question.
You have asked that question more than three times.
It has not been answered.
She answered the question in the way she understood it.
Okay, what was the answer?
She said to you it's about the removal of the public protector from the office.
That's not what I asked him.
So what is it that you're asking?
Can
you point us to this presentation?
I'm not pointing to anything. I'm asking a question. I'm saying, I can't believe how simple this thing is. It's like, did you The fun thing, Mr. Ibrahim, did you fly this morning from Johannesburg, yes or no? I mean, simple. Did you say this morning that Section 194 concerns an office and not a person? I mean,
I said very clearly that it is a question of the removal of a person from the office. That's what Section 194 says.
Okay, I give up. Alright. And let me remind you again, sir, and for the purpose of the process, your job here, I thought, is to assist the committee, not to be evasive, not to try to assist or not assist any side. It's simply to come and assist. So really, you are the one witness for whom the answers should be very easy, because you are just helping all of us, I thought. But it's fine, I give up on that question. Now, whatever you said or did not say this morning, do you accept now that these proceedings concern a person, not the removal of an office?
That's correct.
You accept that?
That's correct. Okay. So just to support Mr. Ibrahim, Honorable Melda?
That's what the poor is suggesting, that we're talking, you are here to remove an office. That's what you've just now said. Read what says Section 194, removal from the office. Nobody says removal of the office. I don't understand what's going on.
That is true. Okay. The witness said you'll be embarrassed when you read what he said this morning, which is that Section 194 does not concern a person, but concerns an office. He said it. You may not have heard it or whatever, but when you read the record, as I say, you'll be embarrassed. But or at least one of us will be when the record speaks for itself. But be that as it may, you've denied saying it, and now it's also being denied on your behalf. But the record will speak for itself. Now, if we then agree that it is about the removal of a person, right, then you would also agree that the suspension of that person must be done in accordance with Section 194.3a.
That's correct, yes. Right.
And you'd also agree that if there is non-compliance with that section, that would affect the fairness of the process.
If there's non-compliance with Section 194.3a.
Yes. It would have an impact on the fairness of this process. In other words, if there's an unlawful suspension or premature suspension of a person, then the process itself would be tainted by that illegality.
I don't agree.
You don't agree?
I don't agree. There's two separate issues, if I may explain.
Fair. I know there are separate issues,
yeah.
So, but they are all, they are both contemplated in Section 194.3a,
yeah.
No?
That's correct, but they're two separate issues. The suspension of the public protector in terms of 194.3a is quite a different to the question of dealing with the resolution concerning the removal of office.
How can that be if the suspension is dependent directly on the process for the removal?
The issue really is the suspension takes place, if I may read it, it says may suspend the person from office at any time after the start of the proceedings. So if the committee had started working, it would be sufficient enough to allow for that suspension to start come into operation.
Right. And if the removal proceedings have not started?
If the committee had not started work.
No, so don't talk about work. There's no, do you see the word work here?
No, if after the start of proceedings of the committee. Yes.
So if the removal proceedings have not started?
That should take place after the start of the proceedings for of the committee.
Thank you. And we know that because, as we have just read in that section, in 206, that the what you have called the institutional predetermination has to happen before. And if you go to paragraph 178 of that same judgment, for the impeachment process to commence, the assembly must have determined that one of the listed grounds exists. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
So until the predetermination of the existence of the grounds has been finalized, the impeachment process or removal process cannot commence. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Thank you. And if it doesn't commence, then you also cannot suspend before its commencement, correct?
The committee has to start. Yes.
Thank you. That's all wanted to establish on that score. And you would agree that the what we call the institutional predetermination stage is where we are now of the existence of the ground, sir.
The institutional predetermination has already taken place.
Oh, when was that?
I thought that that took place with the definitions identified in what the definitions of misconduct and was.
Again, I've asked you a simple question. When was that? You said it has already taken place.
That's in the document that was put together.
Oh, you mean when the rules were adopted?
The rules, yes.
All right, that would be the 3rd of December 2019. Well, I'm just telling you, that's when the rules were adopted. So you're saying the removal process started after then?
That's what it's the date, so I don't have the...
No, I assume I'm correct with the date.
Yeah.
The rules were adopted on the 3rd of December 2019. So in your expert analysis, that's when the proceedings started.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. And you seriously think that's what Justice Jaffna meant by that there must be an institutional predetermination of the existence of the ground?
That's my view, yes.
Thank you. I think for what it's worth, we will continue, but I think we could even stop right here. So effectively then, there was no need for this judgment of the Constitutional Court, because all that needed to happen would have been for rules which define the what serious misconduct in the case of Section 89, and then off we go.
May I read to you what the document says and what my submission was? May I?
Yeah, you can do that, but you must just answer the question first.
in paragraph 93.3, this is what was said, okay, of my document that I submitted to you. Under the Constitution, only the National Assembly may remove the President from office. The Constitution does not define the grounds of impeachment, including what constitutes serious misconduct, and has left the detail of those definitions of the National Assembly. However, the Constitution's intent was not to leave the definitions up to the individual members, else there would be divergent views on what amounts to serious conduct. Accordingly, there must be an institutional predetermination of what constitutes serious misconduct. That's what I said.
Yeah. You and I agreed a few minutes ago that we are the institutional predetermination of the existence, whether it's misconduct or serious misconduct, encompasses an inquiry to do that.
It doesn't necessarily encompass an inquiry, no.
Oh.
The predetermination is not an inquiry. It's a definition. It's predetermination, and the committee has to apply its mind as to what constitutes a misconduct then. And that has been defined.
Yeah. All right. No, that's fine. We'll come back to that.
So as you continue, so Mr. Ibrahim, and that has been defined where in the rules of the National Assembly, as you read to us today?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, like you said, another was on the 3rd of December 2019. Assuming I'm correct on the date. Okay.
If I may just be more clear, in paragraph 92.5
of
my submission, it's headed definition of misconduct.
Oh.
It says the removal rules define the concept of misconduct with reference to gross negligence and intention, which forms of fault are not prescribed by the Constitution.
Oh.
This, however, is entirely permissible. So the definition of the misconduct has been clearly specified, and that was what was included in the removal rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I understand. I think we're together. No, I think it was the chair who just wanted to emphasize. I was saying both what you and him are saying, then place that the event, happening of that event on the 3rd of December 2019. Agreed?
I'm not aware of the exact dates, but that's what I submitted.
Yes. And according to you, seriously, that is what the Constitutional Court meant when it says the following. Without accepting that one of the listed grounds existed, just that, does that in your estimation involve an inquiry or not into the existence of that ground? Not to the definition now, whether it actually exists. In other words, whether the person, whether there's misconduct or gross misconduct or whatever.
Yes. The issue there was that there was no predetermination of really the definitions and that was identified. And so the grounds itself, it had to be clearly specified, yes.
Okay, I think just to be fair, let me give you a second chance at this one. You are seriously suggesting to this committee that when the Constitutional Court says there must be a determination of the existence of a ground, that simply means the definition, not the inquiry into the actual existence, the establishment of the ground. That's your evidence?
My evidence is that there must be predetermination so that there be a common understanding of really, in the rules, what would constitute misconduct.
You've already said that. That's
yeah.
That's the definition.
Yeah.
I'm saying once that is done,
you think that this reference of saying that you cannot authorize a commencement of a process which can result in the removal without establishing that the ground exists. And I said to you when I was reading it, underline the word exist. You're sticking to the your version that is not an inquiry.
I'm sticking to my version. The point here is that there has to be a predetermination of the definitions of really what is construed, and then the committee starts. And once the committee starts, the suspension can take place.
Yeah, but what committee? I mean, when they adopt the rules on the 3rd of December 2019, there's not even a complaint. So you're saying that even before there's a complaint, the existence of the...
Just a pause, Honorable Heron.
The existence of the ground can be determined, sorry.
I'm sorry, Chair, and sorry, Advocate Impopo, to interrupt. Can we get the paragraph on the screen, as we did with the previous judgment?
Yes, okay. The one I'm reading on now, Mr. Heron, is...
It's the 2018 case, paragraph 170.
No, I started at 178. The one I'm reading to him now is 205. Whoever, I don't know where the person is. Are you okay? Thank you. Brian, as I said, I gave you a second chance to be fair. And you're saying you're sticking with your answer. If you go to I asked you to read at 179, just go to the next paragraph, which is 180. So that it's clear that what you're saying is wrong about the absence of an inquiry, but that is just about definition. It says that, therefore, any process of removing the president from office must be preceded by a preliminary inquiry during which the assembly determines that a listed ground exists. I've been trying to explain this. The form of this preliminary inquiry may take depends entirely upon the assembly. Okay, that's obvious. Maybe an investigation or some other form of inquiry, also up to assembly to decide whether the president must be afforded a hearing at the preliminary stage. Do we now at least both agree that predetermination involves an inquiry? Please answer.
Yeah, I'm just having a look at 180.
Take your time.
Thank you very much, sir. Yeah, 180 is fairly clear. It says, therefore, any process for removing the president from the office must be preceded by a preliminary inquiry during which the assembly determines that the listed ground exists. The form
which such a preliminary inquiry may take depends entirely upon the Assembly. That's what it says.
Yeah, you just read what I read to you. That's not my question. My question is, do we now agree between you and me that that institutional predetermination involves some form of inquiry on the existence of the ground?
I think we are referring to two different things. We're referring to two different things. Here is, we have said that the court is referring to an inquiry, a preliminary inquiry. It says there must be a preliminary inquiry during which the Assembly determines the ballistic ground exists.
Okay. Let me make this simple. Do you accept as a matter of just general, as a human being, that the existence of a ground for anything, whether it's in a labor law or whatever, is determined only by an inquiry?
No, not necessarily, no. Why would that
okay.
be the case? The existence of a ground could be based on a complaint. There's a complaint that there was misconduct.
Yes.
There,
no.
There's a ground.
Okay. No,
which clearly states this is a ground, there was misconduct based on this, and that's a ground. It doesn't require an inquiry, it requires an inquiry to determine that.
All right. Okay, let's use that analogy of yours. So the complaint, let's say I go and complain at the police station, and I say, so-and-so assaulted me. That's the complaint. Okay? And then we say, now there must be a determination of the existence of that criminal ground of complaint. Can that be determined without any form of inquiry or trial or whatever?
I still think you are conflating two things.
What are they?
The one is the predetermination. The predetermination relates to a very clear requirement, which is the Constitution doesn't define misconduct. The Assembly is called upon to define that, and that's where the predetermination takes place. What you are referring to in with regard to one, Section 180 is really the inquiry. So the inquiry is based on a complaint. It's not report. It's based on the definition. Okay.
Sorry,
the Constitution identifies clear grounds on which
uh-huh.
there could be a removal.
Uh-huh.
Those relate to misconduct and serious misconduct, depending on which you look at.
Uh-huh.
What the Constitution, what is required of the National Assembly is for a predetermination to take place. And that predetermination requires a definition of really what misconduct really would be. And that took place, that predetermination took place in terms of the rules, okay? What you are referring to in this is not a question of the predetermination. It doesn't talk about the predetermination. It talks about the inquiry.
I see.
It's subsequent to the
so you're
predetermination
saying
of the grounds.
Yeah, that's what is referred to in 180 in your estimation. Is different to what that which is referred to in 178. You can roll up to 178. This means there must be an institutional determination of what serious violation of the Constitution of the law is. The
yes.
same must apply to misconduct or review. This is evident from the language. Once more, it is left to the Assembly to determine the circumstances under which the President removed from office on one or two grounds may forfeit benefit. Then it says, for the impeachment process to commence, assembly must have determined that one of the listed grounds exists. Do you understand the difference between existence and definition? Or are you saying there's no difference?
No, it says, and since the determination of these matters falls within the exclusive jurisdiction of the assembly and it alone is entitled to determine them. This means that there must be an institutional predetermination of what a serious violation of the constitution or law reform or law is, which is that they need to define the definition of a serious violation. Yes?
Okay. Let's
the same must apply to serious misconduct. It must define in the predetermination what serious misconduct is, and that should be in the rules, and the inability to perform the functions of the office. I think that speaks for itself.
Yes. Okay. I promise you we're going to move on now because I don't think we're going to make any headway, but I'll give you a last chance. And here, when I read this, you must concentrate on the two words, exist and established. Okay. So next paragraph. For the impeachment process to commence, the assembly must have determined that one of the listed grounds exists. Then the next sentence. This is so because those grounds constitute conditions for the removal. A removal of the president when none of the grounds is established would not be a removal contemplated in terms of section 891. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Do you also think that the establishment of the existence of a ground simply means its definition? Are you seriously saying that?
That's what I'm saying, yes. It needs the definition of misconduct.
Yeah.
And serious misconduct needs to be set out. And that's what was set out in the rules. It's a predetermination of what they are. You cannot hold the inquiry without actually doing that.
Without establishing the existence of the ground.
No, without establishing really what misconduct means.
Can you do it without establishing the existence of the ground?
Existence of a ground is quite a separate issue.
Yes.
Because the grounds are identified, the basis for removal are identified in the Constitution. What isn't identified is a definition of what that means, right? What misconduct really means. And therefore the rules, the National Assembly had to predetermine through its rules what misconduct means. And once it had done that, at least it could then proceed.
Thank you. Now I understand that part of your answer. We've gone through it ad nauseum.
Just a pause, advocate in both. Just a little pause there, apology. Just before you come. Once those rules were concluded, what was the next step that happened?
Inquiry takes place. Then the National Assembly is entitled to pursue the inquiry.
Do you mean the panel?
Yes.
Oh,
not the panel, but the committee. Even if any committee established by the National Assembly, an inquiry takes place. What 193, the reference to...
I'm seeking clarity at Advocate Mbofu.
Yes.
Please don't...
You didn't clarify by introducing something that the witness didn't say.
No, I'm seeking clarity. Please conclude. Conclude, Mr. Ibrahim. You done?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Advocate Mbofu.
Okay. You know, Mr. Ibrahim, unfortunately, I have to ask you this question. And unfortunately, we need to make sure that this committee doesn't say one day it did not know, you know, the Nuremberg defense, whether it's involved in illegality or not. I'm saying to you, simple question. Do you agree that there cannot be a removal process without establishing the existence of the ground, not its definition, the existence of the misconduct, the incompetence, the incapacity? as defined. Maybe let me help you like that. Let's assume the definition already happened 100 years ago. Do you accept that there cannot be a removal process without establishing the existence of that ground that was defined 1,000 years ago?
All that is required in terms of the Constitution is that a committee needs to be established dealing with the inquiry based on the allegation that there had been serious misconduct.
True. That's true. But do you then accept that until that committee makes a finding as to the existence of otherwise of the ground, the alleged ground, then that inquiry, or rather that removal cannot take place?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, but I'll tell you what the Constitution says. That I can read it for you. It says the president may suspend the person from the office at any time after the start of the proceedings of a committee of the National Assembly for the removal of that person. Don't talk about anything else. Once a committee has been established for the removal of the person, the suspension can take place.
So now you're changing your evidence.
No, I'm not.
No, let me tell you why, to assist you. You're saying two different things, and I'll assist you by giving them dates, okay? The definition of the offences, for lack of a better word, was done on the 3rd of December 2019, right? The establishment of this committee happened on the 16th of March 2021. Those two dates cannot be the same date. We agree on that.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, which of those two dates are you talking about when you're saying there was a predetermination of the...
Once the rules were established, defining what misconduct and serious misconduct was, that was the predetermination that was required. It then offered the National Assembly the opportunity then to institute and establish the committee, which would be then as referred to 194.3A.
And that committee, its job is to determine whether the alleged ground exists, correct?
No. You are reading something into it which I cannot read in the Constitution. The Constitution is very clear. It says the president may suspend a person from office at any time after the proceedings of a committee of the National Assembly for the removal. If the committee has been established at any time after the committee has been established, the president may proceed with the removal. However, what we agreed is that the committee needed the predetermination. That predetermination of what constitutes misconduct had to be in the rules, and that was clearly set out in the rules.
I'll read it to you what it says in the rules, and then you'll tell me if that is the same thing. So the committee must, when the assembly has approved the recommendations of independent panel in terms of rules, Rule 129, that proceeds to conduct an inquiry and establish the veracity of the charges and report to the assembly thereon. Do you understand that? Establish, that's the word I said you must underline when I was reading the Constitutional Court judgment. Establish the veracity of the charges.
Sorry, which rule are you?
Oh, I'm sorry, it's 129A. Sorry, Mr. Ren. 129AD.
Yes, Mr. Mello.
Yeah, perhaps this is I'm trying to follow.
word here, and I'm perhaps not understanding clearly. And I really want to understand the nature of your question, Advocate Mpofu. Are you suggesting that for the suspension to take place, the committee has to make a finding first? Is that what you're trying to lead up to? Or are you suggesting that there is, at some point in the committee process, the suspension can take place? I'm trying to understand where you're going with this.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. That's where I'm going. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. You said, am I establishing whether there must be a determination, or rather an inquiry, which has the finding or a determination, whatever you call it? Yes.
At yourself. Thank you, Chair. So the advocate is suggesting that this committee must make a finding before a suspension can take place.
Yes, it's not the advocate, it's the Constitutional Court, yeah. It says that there must be a institutional predetermination of the existence of that ground.
So, yeah, I understand what the Constitutional Court says. What I'm asking you, and the Constitutional Court speaks specifically to the removal, does not talk to the suspension. So my question to you, Advocate, is whether or not this committee has to make a finding before a suspension can occur.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Myler.
Do you understand the issue now?
I understood the issue all along. The point is that I don't agree with you.
You did? Okay. Do you also not agree then with the following sentence? You don't agree with the Constitutional Court or with me? It says equally, I'm reading on, I don't know if it's up. A process for removal, that answers what Mr. Mayhem has just said. A process for removal of the president when none of those grounds exist would amount to a process not authorized by the section. Do you agree with that at least?
Yeah.
Okay.
The issue is really the ground would refer to the definition of what misconduct is, not the fact that it
exists.
Yeah.
Okay. So the line, Chapter J, when it says, where none of those plans exist, you are just what? Hallucinating?
No. You are referring to two things. You are conflating two issues, the definition of what the ground is and the inquiry related to that.
Okay, thank you. I think that is as helpful or unhelpful as it can be on that score. But I don't think it's going to help us. So I need to even read the next sentence. Right. Now, we were saying before lunch, I was saying to you that let's do this comparative analysis between the role of the public protector and the role of a judge. Remember that? Now, it is true that, and I think it's contained in your statement, that to some extent the role of a public protector is similar to that of a judge.
No.
No.
I pointed out very clearly to you when I referred to Bishop and Woolman the paragraph is very clear. May I remind you what it said?
Yeah. It says the opposite of what you're saying now.
No.
You'll find it's at your paragraph 24. The passage from Woolman. Read the first sentence.
Bishop and Woolman described the public protector's office in the following terms. It says the public protector's purpose is profitably compared to the role of the judiciary.
Yes.
The courts handle discrete disputes about law and conduct. They rely on correct procedures and solid, sometimes intricate, legal arguments. Courts are simply not designed to handle the large number of complaints that arise from simple misunderstandings or bureaucratic red tape, nor do they lend themselves to the resolution of injustice that turn more on unfairness and illegality, which is really what the public protector deals with. The public protector occupies a middle space in the political constitutional landscape. It serves the public back and assists the courts and the legislature. It assists the courts by addressing those complaints about administration of justice that fall beyond the court's purview. So it's very different. So
okay.
When you profitably compare, then the two deal with different things. So you, that's the comparison is about the difference, not similarity.
Okay, let me ask you differently. Do you agree that the public protector, similar to the courts, also deals with the administration of justice?
There's no question about it. It's the different parts of the administration of justice.
Thank
you. The public protector will deal with unfairness, and the courts will deal with illegality, the compliance with the law.
Yes.
And
the therefore,
two are different.
They both
deal with administration of justice.
They do. Okay, good. And to that extent, the public protector assists the courts.
Correct.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to say. So that's the first point of intersection. Secondly, you also agree that the remedial action of the public protector is binding, as are court orders, correct?
Yes. It can only be challenged on judicial review.
Correct.
No question.
And thirdly, you would agree that there's no other constitutional public office holder who is protected by contempt of, somebody going to prison for contempt.
Correct.
The only persons who have that protection, constitutional protection, are judges and the public protector.
Judges don't, courts do. It's a distinction. The public protector is not in the constitution, it's by the public protector act under the subheading of contempt of the public protector.
Are you being serious now? So judges are not protected by contempt?
It's the court that is protected.
Yes, I know the
contempt
court is
of
protected.
Court. You have contempt of court proceedings.
Yes. Are judges not protected by the offense of contempt?
I'm clearly I'm clear of the offense of the contempt of court. I'm not sure if I quite agree about the contempt of a judge.
Okay. So if you insult a judge and if you insult the public protector, you go to jail.
If you insult the public protector, you're clearly going to go to jail in
yes.
terms of that.
And if
no
you insult a judge?
I'm not aware of the offense. Perhaps you could enlighten me. Do you?
Have you ever heard of a case called State versus Mama Bulo? Chris Lack. Jay?
No.
Okay, you don't have to know that particular case. But your evidence is seriously that if you insult a judge, then you're not within the ambit of contempt.
No, I'm not. That's not my evidence. My evidence is merely I'm not aware of that. I'm clearly aware of the crime of the offense of contempt of a public protector. No, I have cited that in the act. And
protection in the Public Protector Act, which is an unusual offence.
Yes, not only is it unusual, it's unprecedented. I'm saying that that is a protection that is given to the Public Protector uniquely.
Correct, that's my understanding.
I'm just trying to get to assist you so that next time if you ever testify in this thing, you should know.
Where are we now, Advocate Mbofu?
In what, in terms of geography or?
No, you don't respond to me like that.
Where?
I'm asking. You're now saying you want to assist him for the next, in case he appears. Exactly, I mean, the kind of language you're using here consistently is becoming disrespectful.
What are you
and now I'm asking you a question about geography. Where is geography to do with the question that I'm asking, which is very specific?
No, I don't know what you're asking, I'm trying to understand. What's the question?
I will not repeat that question.
Thank you. All right. Yes, okay.
Listen, we all have lots of things to do. It's not for, really, if you want to assist the witness for future reference, please don't waste our time doing so.
And sir, you'll allow that kind of language?
No, he's asking you not to waste our time. I forget them both. It's important.
Thank you.
And that perhaps you need to indicate how far you are on the kind of questions you're going to be putting forward. Yes.
If you go to section 91B, the Public Protector.
Okay, Advocate Mayosic, I suppose.
Before you proceed, Advocate Mbofu, could you perhaps give us the citation for S versus Mamabolo?
No, I don't. I'll give it to you later.
You don't have it now.
Okay. No, I can find it. That's what I was saying. It doesn't work like that. If you need a citation, it means you must wait for it. Then you have to wait for it. And then you tell me I mustn't waste the time. I mean, which is. I can find the citation, but if you want me to find it.
It's not you, you have a team here.
Yeah. Even the team is not sitting here on F versus Mamabolo. That's something. So should we want us to wait for the team to find it? Okay.
Honorable Lagode.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I think this is Section 194, the Parliamentary Inquiry. Then in Parliament, when we are doing our work, when you quote something, you should distribute the documents to all members so that we can read from what you are quoting. But if you don't have that, please don't quote, because we have nothing to refer to.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I think that's exactly why I did not quote that case. But thanks.
Can you please proceed with your questions?
Yes. The question is, Section 9 says that no person shall insult the public protector or deputy public protector.
Yes.
We agree that that refers to the person.
That's what it says.
But it refers to a person, not an office, to a person.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And then it says, in connection with an investigation, do anything which, if the said investigation had been proceeding in a court of law, would have constituted contempt of court. Now, the simple question I was really asking you is, on a reading of that question, or rather of that section, would you agree that it therefore, in terms of contempt, equates the public protector, that is the person, to a judge? In other words, if you are to insult a judge, you'd be fallen by the same fate.
I don't think I can agree with you. You're referring to a court of law, proceedings in a court of law. If the said investigation had been proceedings in a court of law, which would have constituted contempt of court.
Yes.
Yeah. If
in other words, if you had, instead of, if the person you are insulting was not a public protector now standing in front of you, but a judge.
Basically, if I understand Section 9 clearly, it merely refers to no person shall insult the public protector or deputy public protector. It's fairly basic. You cannot insult the person.
Yeah. No, that's fine. We'll deal with that, I think, at the end. I'm also leaving that question just to the so don't waste the time of the honorable member. I think the section speaks for itself. But now we agree, you agree that the powers of the public protector are very wide.
That was my submission, yes.
So wide that it's difficult, if not impossible, to define their limits.
Defined by the only two limits to that would be the question of 2 years, and the public protector is not allowed to question a decision of court.
To investigate a court decision.
That's correct.
Right. Apart from that, those powers are extensive and limitless.
Well, I would say it is extensive, yes.
Yes. Okay, and quite right. When I say limitless, I'm using, in the sense that obviously
much.
The rule of law will constrain it. But
it's extensive.
Yes, but do you agree that apart from being extensive, the limits are not easy to define?
There's no definition on that.
Yes. And that is important because some of the charges here relate to whether those powers were exceeded in certain cases, and in certain cases whether they were not practiced. I don't want you to get into the merits. I'm just telling you the importance of the question. Now, the question for you is whether the public protector has got the ability, for example, if a complaint comes, to extend the scope of the investigation, or even to limit it?
Not to extend it. Public protector may not extend the investigation.
Really? Have you read the Mail and Guardian judgment?
Yeah.
You have?
They do not extend investigations beyond the state of affairs into the affairs of private entities. So,
sorry? Okay, let me ask you a simple question. Don't worry about the beyond whatever. Do you agree that the public protector has the capacity to extend the scope of a complaint?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
She doesn't have a discretion to extend a complaint?
The scope of it, no.
Okay. Does she have the discretion to limit it?
I suppose if there were reasonable grounds on the basis of which to do so, they were justifiable, yes.
And if there were reasonable grounds to extend?
If there were reasonable grounds to extend, then that could also be done.
Right.
And one of the, again, I'm giving you this background. One of the key charges here is about the so-called CX matter. Are you familiar with that? That's the one about the APSA lifeboat.
Yeah.
Yes. And the big issue which has been presented by those who protest here is that the public protectors' remedial action would have necessitated the amendment of the constitution. You must remember that, even maybe just from, if you haven't read the case. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So you must say yes, so that it's recorded.
Yes, yes.
Thank you. Now, you do agree that the extensive powers of the public protector may even extend to those matters where which might necessitate a constitutional amendment.
No. I'll tell you why.
Hmm.
Because the according to the constitutional require or definition of an organ of state, there could be no encroachment of powers between the organs of state. There could be remedial action. Yes, there could be remedial action. And I believe that the public protector has a right to issue remedial action. Yes.
Oh, I'm asking a different question. I'm saying if she issued a question, a remedial action that might necessitate a constitutional change, would that be misconduct in your estimation?
Chairperson, this is a matter that goes into the merits of the case. I really want to steer clear from the merits of the case. This is not my terrain. It's not my remit. It's not my brief. And so it's a matter that is really beyond.
Oh, but for, you told us for the whole morning about where the powers can be circumscribed. So it's too late now to make up.
Are you indicating that you're not in a position to answer that?
No.
Thank you. Proceed with your written both.
Are you not in a position to tell us whether the limits, or rather whether the extension, which you and I have agreed, might be needed on reasonable grounds, may or may not include issues which might require a constitutional amendment?
No.
They are unable. Okay. And just generally, other administrative bodies, to your knowledge, as an expert of some sort, to your knowledge, other administrative bodies can make proposals that involve constitutional amendments without being impeached.
A constitutional amendment can be raised by whether a body of parliament or from outside. There's no question of that.
Including the public protector.
As a public protector, yes, as a public.
As a public protector,
we should make a submission.
Thank you.
That there ought to be an amendment of the constitution that would be entitled just like anybody else in the country would be.
No, thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you very much. And then you agree that also the public protector should not be held responsible for legal advice that you might obtain. Whether it's correct or not correct is another matter.
Please repeat that.
Do you also agree that the public protector should not be held responsible for legal advice that you might obtain from lawyers, whether external lawyers or internal lawyers?
She should not be held responsible for that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what your question really is.
Would you agree that if
her fault. Let me put it that way. Well, the public protector is required to be a person of at least 10 years of legal experience and a legal expert in field, and supposed to be familiar with the law, is required to have that familiarity with the law, and therefore on the basis of that, if the public protector wishes to accept a view, then the public protector as an expert in her own right, as a legal expert, it's not a question of fault or not, but she has taken the decision to accept that legal advice and adopted it.
I don't understand the answer again. I'm asking you a simple question.
The public protector is required by to be a lawyer of substance, of senior, regarded as a senior legal officer. And that senior legal officer obtains legal advice. As a senior legal officer, receiving that advice and adopting that advice, there's no legal question about it. The public protector has adopted that position.
Public protector is what?
You're asking whether the public protector may accept advice from a legal advisor.
No, okay. I think that's the problem. That's not my question. Do you accept that if the...
I think the question is, are there certain legal advice that the public protector may receive from certain legal advocates that she should rather not accept or not be responsible for?
I'm not aware of any compulsion to ignore legal advice.
To ignore, yeah, okay. Well, that was honorable Mulder's question. Let's come back to my question. I'm saying nothing to do with ignoring legal advice. I'm asking you a different question. Do you accept that if the public protector receives legal advice and implements it in good faith, and that legal advice may have come from senior counsel or external people or even internal people, that then she's entitled to implement that advice if she accepts it in good faith? Simple.
I see no reason why not. As I said, the public protector is regarded constitutionally as an extremely senior legal officer. And having adopted a particular legal advice, that would be it.
Purpose of the question, would Advocate Mpofu be suggesting that if the public protector then acts on that wrong advice, that she will not be responsible?
Are you cross-examining me?
Could I repeat the question? Yes, I'm addressing Advocate Charlie Mpofu.
Thank you. Yes.
Let me try again.
Okay.
I'm trying to get behind the gist of your question.
Yes.
Understand the gist of your question? It is that if the public protector receives legal advice and she acts on that advice and the advice is wrong, that she would not be responsible. Is that the gist of what you're trying to say to her?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I told you yesterday I have a quarrel. I've got another quarrel today. I couldn't understand why you allow Mr. Ibrahim Patel to be questioned when the advocate says you're not an expert and then starts questioning you as if he's an expert. I can't come around that. Right? Then secondly, I also mentioned the fact it costs us R1 million a day, the fiscus for legal costs. We've already dragged this for 2 years. We've already got 2 days. I don't want to listen to experts and people say, but you're not an expert, Mr. Patel. I want the veracity of the allegations to be tested by us. So why don't you, Mr. Chairman, put the allegations before us, give the version, and get the public protector to have a so-called day in court and answer to that? Why are you dragging this? Why are we involved with procedural matters? Can't you get to the crux of the matter?
Thank you, Honorable Hendricks. I understand your point. I sympathize with it. That time will come. There are certain steps that we've got to navigate and go through. We have, now that I'm speaking now, we have the first witness in front of us who has taken us through in a comprehensive presentation on that institution and that office. It's in the nature of such hearings that not everything that is going to be engaged on will be palatable and would be what you expect. So we will get to that point. We're starting tomorrow with witnesses in relation to some of these issues. So I want, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Hendricks. Honorable Nwola?
No, I just want to say it's Mr. Ibrahim, that is not Patel.
Thank you. That's okay, there is Ibrahim Patel, so that's the issue that he might have confused. So please forgive him for saying that. Advocate Mpofu, I'm coming back to you and I'm hoping that you're closer to wrapping up.
No, I'm not. So, would you agree with this sentiment which was expressed by the Constitutional Court or not? We may criticize the public protector for failing to realize that the legal point she was obviously advised to advance was a non-starter, but can we really go far with that criticism? I think not. She got advice from senior counsel. Of importance, we do not know whether the public protector has any experience in civil legal practice, and the commissioner did not suggest that she does. That, for me, is the end of the matter. Do you generally agree with that sentiment, that if she got senior advice, in this case, even from senior counsel, then that should be the end of the matter?
Just before you respond, Mr. Ibrahim, Advocate Mayosi.
I think they anticipated my question, which was similar. If we could have just the citation, so that we can put it up if we can find it.
It's Commissioner for SARS. This is Public Protector. 2022, Volume 1, 370 Constitutional Court Cases. At, I think, paragraph 50.
That's the minority judgment of Judge
McQueen. It's the unanimous majority judgment of Mashanga.
Thank you. Mr. Ibrahim?
I thought we were waiting for the judgment to come up. Are they drawing it up?
Okay.
Are they going to, so that one
you
can
heard what I
you're,
said.
You're asking me to apply my mind to
yeah, okay.
The statement.
Now we'll flag it.
I'm out of the
meantime, while we're waiting for may I assist you with one point, which is that in the rules, what the rules do is that with regard to the question of legal lack of knowledge and so on, the definition of incompetence is as follows in terms of the rules. It says it's concerned with both a lack of knowledge and ability or skill to discharge the functions of the office.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
What question are you answering?
You had asked
Mr. Ibrahim,
yes.
You're talking through the chair.
My apologies.
You're not talking to him, and he's responding to your question. I forget them both. And I don't appreciate that kind of line of questioning that you're doing. He's responding to a question that you're putting to him. So when he responds, I don't know why you would come with such a reaction to his responses.
The person, what question? Which question was
that? Just asking whether he's talking to you. And I'm correcting you now. Whatever that you do next, you're going to be speaking through the chair.
Correct.
As questions are posed to you. Please proceed.
Jefferson, what I was merely referring to, the advocate Mpofu asked the question with regard to legal advice and what to do with it. I was merely referring to the rules which define incompetence. And I merely state it as it is, because the rules have defined incompetence in the removal rules, and which is concerned with the duties of the public protector, by saying it's concerned with both the lack of knowledge and the ability or skill to discharge the functions of office. I'm merely stating what the rules say.
Oh, I thought you were putting up the paragraph. Now, can you answer my question?
Yes, sir.
Which is, do you agree with the sentiment expressed by Matanga J that if the public protector has accepted legal advice from senior counsel, that should be the end of the matter?
I'm not sure the end of the matter meaning what, but the public protector is entitled to receive whatever advice the public protector gets. Whether the public protector is responsible for that advice is quite a different story.
No, sir. Okay, I'll read it again. I'm talking about criticizing or blaming the public protector. We may criticize the public protector for failing to realize that the legal point she was obviously advised to advance as a non-starter. But can we really go far with that criticism? In other words, will that criticism be valid? I think not. She got the advice from senior counsel. Of importance, we do not know whether the public protector has any experience in civil legal practice. The commissioner did not suggest that she does. For me, that is the end of the matter. Do you agree with that sentiment? I'm not saying not every word or every comma, but with the sentiment expressed by the Constitutional Court, or do you differ with the Constitutional Court?
I'll actually differ with that. I have a different view.
Thank you. And if we had to choose, you would agree that we have to choose the view of the unanimous Constitutional Court?
There's no question that the court's decision is binding. You asked me a different question. You asked me whether I agreed with the sentiment. I said I don't agree with the sentiment.
Yes, I'm asking you a different thing now. I don't know why you're going back to the previous question. I'm saying, do you agree that since you don't agree, the committee should prefer the view of the unanimous Constitutional Court to that of you or me?
Without a question.
Thank you.
Let's see.
I think it would have been fair for Mr. Mpofu to Advocate Spoffer to put the entire paragraph 50 to the witness.
Okay, good. I could even do the entire judgment. Okay. And then to put it up, no, that's fine. I have no problem. I'll read this.
Honorable Lusico, a lot read at Mola.
Yeah.
That order. Now, Chair, I just on a point of procedure. Once dealt with a matter referred to us, now as a committee of parliament, we were told that we have got no right to make an opinion on a matter that is on another arm of state. In this case, the constitutionality or non-constitutionality cannot be subjected to a legislature. Now, I'm just worried about one thing, that I just want to check probably with the advocate both. Is it what was referring to a judgment of the court? And if it is a judgment of the court, what became a recourse of this committee in expressing opinion on a judgment of an another arm of state within the judiciary. I'm just doing it for the sake of the committee. Maybe we can get an advice. But I fear a situation where we may end up making, because if it is expressed here, it means we may also have to develop an attitude on what has been raised. And will it be fair for a committee, a separate arm of state, to agree or disagree or get a view that agrees or disagrees with a judicial outcome? I think that's the only area I would need clarity, so that we don't sound like we ended up encroaching on an area that is not ours. Constitutionality or non-constitutionality, we're told clearly that's not a parameter for another, for a legislature. I think that's the issue I wanted to change.
Thank you, Honorable. I'll quickly go to you and go to Honorable Lotrit and Mola.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Yes, very quickly. Thank you, Honorable Elizabeth. I think there are three quick issues that you raised by what you are saying. The first one is the sentiment that was raised by the evidence leaders yesterday, which you'll remember I disagreed with, where she said court judgments are binding on the committee. And I said that in the context that the committee cannot be bound in the same way as a court. But obviously, a court's judgment is a court judgment. It's there. You can't deny it. So that's the first level. The second level is that the committee is not called upon to express any opinion on those judgments. And actually, the issue you're raising is very serious because it goes to the core of why we're here. You'll remember, if you read the independent panel report, that there's only one charge to do with a Mr. Samuel that is not based on a court judgment. So the whole thing that has got us here is based on court judgment. So there is that issue. Then the third issue, which is even a more serious issue, is the issue of sub judice, which I think what you are alluding to as well. And I must confess, I'm also worried about that, because the issue of, for example, not on this thing that we're discussing now, but on all these other issues about the stacking and not stacking and the resistance of the ground and so on, we all know, I reported here yesterday, that those issues are going to be debated in court on the 25th and 26th. So I think that concern can only be in that third category. The first two, I think, were fine. But as to whether the issues about this committee continuing when the matter is coming into its time on the interpretation and the conflict and all that, that's not my area. That's something for the committee.
Honorable Lotrit.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I am very concerned because it has happened quite a few times now that reference is made to specific judgments and only paragraphs. This puts this committee at distinct disadvantage because we do not have the context, because it is easy to cite from a particular judgment, but we don't know what the whole case was about. So up to now, this morning, Mr. Ibrahim focused on a document that we were presented with earlier. We could prepare. But now new cases are being mentioned. And I quite frankly feel very disenfranchised here that I cannot assess it and I cannot take the most out of whatever advocate or is saying. Thank you.
Sir, can I respond to
Honorable Mala.
Thanks, Chair. No, mine is on a different angle. Mr. Mbofu started with cross-examination before the lunchtime. Went to lunch. The time now is about 3:45 p.m. After the cross-examination, you still have
about 20 members of parliament that equality afforded time to cross examination the witness on the stand. I'm not sure, Chair, if we are to overlap the program, but it looks like we are moving at a steady pace that may delay and cause the committee to overlap the program. So, Chair, I just wanted to awaken you on the issue of time management, and although you must balance it with allowing the fair chance to everyone to cross-examine the witness on stand, but I think we must be quality conscious of the time we take when we are processing the cross-examination. Thank you very much, it's just that.
Thank you. I think both yourself and Honorable Lottrick, the issues you're raising require my response to it, which I will do. Advocate Mbofu, I had indicated earlier that I'm urging you to wrap up your questions to Mr. Ibrahim, because there's going to be a lot.
Yeah, well, thank you, Chair. No, Chair, I can't wrap up without covering the period that he covered in his 70-page document, which affects the that's what cross-examination is.
So, sorry, don't go there.
Yeah.
So, what are you talking about, Chair of Areas? Because at least by 4, I'm expecting that would have wrapped up with your questions. These are going to be questions that you would not have been able to pose. A time can be rearranged later on at another time, because from tomorrow, in terms of the program that you yourself have seen, we've got witnesses that have been lined up, and we are still going to meet as a committee to deal with the issues of directings and so on. So I'm urging you to please prioritize what you want to put forward.
Yeah. No, thank you, sir. No, I misunderstood you. When you say wrap up, I thought you meant I must finish. But if I don't finish at 4, I don't finish. Then we'll make the arrangements you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure. I'm saying, that's just before you proceed. Honorable Melba and then Honorable Maute on the platform.
Okay.
Just to come back to the paragraph that Darlene Paul referred to, and I just want to make sure where which one is referred to and where we have a full paragraph.
Yeah, no, I'm coming to that. Actually, I wanted to say to Honorable Lottrick that this case is actually not a new case. It was referred to by Mr. Ibrahim in this document.
It's just called Honorable Mauter.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. I've been listening to my learned colleagues, and I think we want to...
If you go to, for example, I don't see what... I'm sorry,
just hold. Honorable Mauter?
Yes, I'm saying I've been listening to my...
We can't hear you. Your voice is low.
Can you hear me now, Chair? I'm a loud person by nature, so I don't know. Maybe it's your mic that's bad. Can you hear me, Chair?
A bit louder, we can't. We're struggling to hear you.
On the earphone, you can hear. No. I'm very loud, Chair. I think the speaker's that side.
Okay, we can hear you now as it went too much, but we now can hear you.
Okay. No, I was saying, thank you, Chair. I've been listening to my learned colleagues. And I don't want us to find ourselves in a situation where we want to deny Advocate Mbofu the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Ibrahim. He had the whole time in the morning, he was not interrupted, but I've seen a lot of impatience now that Advocate Mbofu is asking. Maybe he's asking difficult questions and uncomfortable questions, but that's why we're here. And also, Chair, we can't be guided by a forward clock. What informs the forward clock? If we have to sit until in the morning, in the early hours, so be it. But let's allow him the fair chance and the fair trial. I don't agree that we should say, no, if we don't finish after 4, we'll sit and I'm saying we are members of parliament. We
conclusion of whether there is any ground for anything on the public protector. So I think let's play fair, including yourself, Chair. Be patient with the advocate. He's a learned advocate, very bright. Let's give
him a thank you, Honorable Maute. Thank you. I've already indicated to Advocate Mpofu that I expect him to wrap up by 4. If there are going to be outstanding questions, we will re-look into that. I've already indicated that. Please don't take us back. Advocate Mpofu.
Okay, I'm saying going forward. What informs the 4 o'clock? That's my question. As a committee member, what is...
I have not recognized you, Honorable Maute. And you're not going to...
Let's forget about the favor and prejudice. Do you agree with that?
That's correct, yes.
And the fear that is spoken about when we say that the public protector's mandate must be carried out without fear, favor or prejudice, with the emphasis on fear. What might that fear, where might it emanate from? Or let me ask it as a leading question. Would you agree that it would most likely come from those that she's investigating?
I think that has been cited very clearly by the courts in all the documentation. So in the certification courts, which is why in the certification judgment, which is why the court required a supermajority for the removal, because the public protector takes decisions regarding the executive and those in power that may be affected. So, yeah, there should be no fear.
You're right. And in the EFF Nkandla case, Justice Mokoena went further by describing her as the biblical David, who has to fight Goliath and also to investigate even those at the
chambers of power or rooms of power. In other words, the most powerful, including the president.
No question about it.
Yeah. And you would agree that, therefore, part of the protection that is required for the public protector would be if she is investigating those powerful persons, such as the president, who might have been able to wield an axe on her, metaphorically speaking. Do you agree?
The only authority that could wield an axe is the National Assembly, because the public protector is accountable to the National Assembly. So it's only from the National Assembly that there could be a wielding of an axe. It requires the National Assembly with the two-thirds majority to declare that. So nobody else can wield an axe.
Okay. Were you in the country on the 9th of June 2022?
Yes.
Okay. Are you aware that the president on that date suspended the public protection?
Yeah.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay. Alright. So, would you say that those persons that she is investigating, who might have the capacity to mete out punitive measures against her, would include those from whom such fear must be, or rather from whom she must be protected?
No.
No?
I don't agree with
you. Okay. So she must not be protected from those she's investigating.
That's not what I'm saying. I said I didn't agree with you.
Yes. No, you don't have to argue, Mr. Ibrahim. I'm simply trying to rephrase the question so that I can understand it. If you want to argue with me, let's not do it here. I'm saying to dispute my statement that those persons from whom she must be protected and from whom she might have reason to fear would include persons that she's investigating who have the capacity to cause her damage.
Public protector, the chairperson, the public protector is entitled to protection against anybody and everybody, and should be allowed to undertake the course of activities and responsibilities. It does not preclude, however, any other authority taking action against the public protector, provided it is within the course of the law. There's nothing wrong with that.
I don't think we're going to make the 4 o'clock deadline. You're not answering my question. I'm asking you, on the basis of the known facts, right? Firstly, I agree with you that the public protector is accountable to the National Assembly. But here we have a unique, very unique constitutional situation. You have said, actually again, earlier on, that the public protector is answerable exclusively to the National Assembly. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yes. You have also said that ordinarily there should be no encroachment of the executive into that domain. Agreed?
Correct.
Yes. You see, this is the issue here. I don't think it's appreciated. One of the members said this thing is simple, but yesterday, but that's the furthest thing from this. Now, given that scenario of exclusive accountability to the National Assembly, the need to prevent any encroachment by the executive, we have something called Section 194(3)(a). Which does the exact opposite at face value. Because it gives, you agree that Section 194 is what is called by the Constitutional Court the ultimate accountability mechanism.
Okay?
Yeah.
Like Section 89.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, in that ultimate accounting mechanism, the constitutional right has introduced a member of the executive called the president. Okay? Yeah. And that's why this idea that the two things have nothing to do with each other, big thing. So we have a situation where the constitutional right has said, in the middle of this ultimate accountability mechanism, the president, as a member of the executive, may suspend. In other words, may cause some damage to the, I'm using that term loosely, to the public protector. You understand that that brings, well, as a constitutional scholar at least, or a constitutional maker, you understand that that's a unique set of circumstances.
Yes. You are conflating again two things. One is the person, and second is the office. If there was an inquiry by the public protector against anybody, that inquiry does not die. It's only because there's been a suspension or whatever. The work carries on.
It carries on how?
The public protector exists, functions, and the public protector is entitled to proceed with whatever activities it is proceeding with.
Yes, but
it's separating the person.
Oh, I'm sorry. But there's one public protector in South Africa.
Yes.
And that person is Advocate Kweba. Do you agree?
Yes.
Do you agree?
Once the action that any action against the president or whoever it is does not die because of suspension. You cannot equate the two because the office still is open. The office still exists. So the functioning of the public protector is continuing. So if there were legal matters, investigations that were being undertaken by the public protector, it's got nothing to do with the suspension. We are conflating the two inappropriately.
Well, okay. Firstly,
the office exists, Jefferson.
Okay. Firstly, you're answering a question I've not come to yet. I'm coming to it, so you can relax. I've asked you a very simpler question. Do you agree that we have a unique circumstance where in the midst of the so-called ultimate accountability mechanism, in the face of the fact that the Constitution says the public protector accounts to the National Assembly, but the Constitution has introduced a member of the executive in that process to do a suspension. That's all really. I don't know what you're talking about. We're coming to this thing about whether it's in the office and, what happens and so on. Just answer my question, if you may.
I'm not sure if I understand your question. I really cannot understand the question at all.
Okay, I'll simplify it even further, and that will be my last attempt. You and I earlier agreed that what triggers a suspension is whether the process, or rather the removal proceedings have started, correct?
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Now, I'm saying that intersection between the activities of the inquiry and the activities of the president, both of which belong to two separate arms of the state.
Correct.
Is a unique conflation of the accountability mechanism where there's an introduction of the executive. I mean, surely that must be clear.
No, I don't agree with your argument.
Okay. Do you know that the president is a member of the executive?
Correct. Yeah,
and this committee is made up of members of the legislature.
That's correct. Yes.
Right. Now, Section 194(3)(a) mentions both in one breath.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So now I'm saying, if the two
separate and we should theoretically stay apart. I mentioned in the same sentence, the same breath, in a particular section of the Constitution, the one basically triggering for the other to act. You don't think that that is a unique situation under the topic of separation of powers?
No.
No. Yes. Okay. Fine.
Recording stopped.